That letter, that was another one from Taipei. I took down and had digitized not too long ago.
Sure.
And I've got a lot of stuff that I got. I mean, I'm too busy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So go ahead. So.
But no, I would appreciate if you have other letters like the letter from Los Baños. If you have them, send them to me. I would love to catalog them with seat documents. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I have a letter from Taipei, which I'll talk to you about after we finish. It's not part of the seat. Yeah. I have some others. Yeah.
And so yeah, so that's basic. So are you ready to?
What? Let me ask you.
Sure.
What are you majoring in?
I'm a history major.
Yeah, okay.
And so I'm I'll be a fourth-year PhD candidate in history. And my research is on environmental history in Sumatra.
Okay.
And so I look at the national park formation in North Sumatra, in Aceh.
And who's your advisor?
Eric Taliacozo.
Yeah.
I work with Eric Taliacozo, and then Wendy Wolford's on my committee in development sociology.
Who?
Wendy Wolford.
Yeah, I know. Who's the third one?
Ray Crabe in history. He does work on geography, historical geography.
Well, I've you know, the funny thing is I've never been to Sumatra.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Indonesia quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I can talk to you about that later, too.
Sure.
let's get started.
Sure, yeah. So I guess my first question was...
are you going to... something you're recording?
Yeah, so I just started it now, so it's recording... now, and then I can edit the recording later out this sort of stuff. I'll set it, where should I set it to get maximum?
You need something?
Well, I was trying to figure out where I could place it so that it can record.
You can hear me, right? I have a low voice.
So. I think right here is fine, because the speaker's right here.
Okay.
And so, so you mentioned in your one, in the paper you sent to me last night that you came here for your undergrad in 1950 from Princeton. And I was just wondering, what took you to Princeton, and then how did you end up majoring in agriculture at Cornell as an undergraduate?
Well, I came from, a background. I was born in Boston and grew up north of Boston. With a family, my stepfather was a doctor, and it was a fairly well-to-do family. So I went to prep school. I went to Exeter. And I guess I ended up at Princeton because a lot of my friends went to Princeton, were going to Princeton from prep school. But then I'm going to be a history major, right? Now, here's the point, you see, for you, you see, I said, well, what was I going to do as a history major? I really enjoyed history, and I had a history professor, his name was Buzzer Hall at Princeton, and what I learned from Buzzer Hall is that one of the best ways to study history is through fiction, not nonfiction.
Sure.
So, that's the most important lesson, because... nonfiction tells you when the battle was and what the date was, but it never tells you what the people were like, see? So we got an assignment once a week to read Darkness at Noon or the Bread and the Wine or anything like that stuff. We got an assignment once a week on a fiction book in a history course.
Sure.
So that, now I don't know if people do that here at Cornell, but anyway, that's an important thing to me, because I can even tell you now, for example, Burma. The best introduction for anybody studying Burma is The Glass Palace. And The Glass Palace is about you should read that as a historian. It's about Burma in the 20th century. It starts with the king being exiled to India, the last king of Burma, and it goes through the whole history of it. It helps understand what's going on right now in Burma because of the ethnic differences and stuff like that and so forth. Now, as I say, I don't know. Do you have a time limit on I can get talking and stuff. And
no, we're not. Okay. I mean, most of the interviews have been about 45 minutes to an hour or something like that. So it's no rush.
That's all right. So much for Princeton. I guess, you know, I've been out west a couple of times, and I thought to myself, you know, as somebody who's a teenager or younger, you know, it'd be nice to be in agriculture, mm-hmm. sort of a cowboy, mm-hmm. you sure. know, like that. And so sometime after my sophomore year at Princeton, I was out west, mm-hmm. and I said to my family, I think I want to study agriculture. Mm-hmm. And most families, I think, might have said at that time, you're crazy. You're going to drop out of Princeton and study agriculture?
Mm-hmm, sure.
My God, what's the matter with you? But they didn't. They said, fine. But you go to Cornell because they have a good agriculture mm-hmm. college. So I go to Cornell and they say, you have a problem. You come from, you're a non-farm background. And mm-hmm. in order to graduate from Cornell, you have to have a year of farm experience.
Okay.
So the administration here in Roberts Hall, they sent me to a dairy farm for 6 months in Greene County.
Okay.
And I learned two things from that experience. I was there, I learned, number one, that I didn't want to be a dairy farmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, 24 hours a day, every day, Sunday.
It's a lot of work, yes.
Yeah, Sunday was the day off, and you only spent 6 hours milking the cows, yeah. And the second thing I learned is that if you are interested in what a farmer is doing, he will tell you anything you want. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, about half a dozen years ago, I was in China, mm-hmm. and I'm talking to a farmer, and I ask mm-hmm. him, you know, how much land do you have? And he said, do you want to know what I really have, or do you want to know what I tell the government? Mm-hmm. Now, that's the same thing you'd have here, mm-hmm. taxes, right?
Sure.
And you have to keep that in mind because it affects the... When you look at the yield at the national level, it's, mm-hmm. it's affected by that. But anyway,
sure.
So that's what I learned there. Then I came mm-hmm. to Cornell, and the first thing, you see, the draft board now is after me. And so when I get into Cornell, before I even register at Cornell, I go to register at ROTC. Mm-hmm. Sure. So to be sure that I've wavered. For 2 years, right?
Yeah.
So I lost a half a year, but I graduated in 1953, and timing is everything mm-hmm. In life. And I graduated about the day the Korean War ended. Mm. Okay. So then I went into the Army, and we were in artillery. Princeton, it was required, so I had 2 years of ROTC in artillery at Princeton, and so I went into the artillery here at Cornell. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, Fort Sill in Oklahoma is the home of the artillery, so I spent a few months there. But they assigned half of the class out of Sill went to Korea, and mm-hmm. the other half went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Mm. That was where I went.
Okay.
11th Airborne Division. Mm. So here I am in the 11th Airborne Division, and the first thing that happens is I go to jump school. See, I have to learn how to jump. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't have some pictures here, but there were several things that happened. One of the interesting things about the military is that I can remember the details much better than I can tell about teaching at Cornell and stuff like that. I don't mm-hmm. know one or the other. But the military, it's just like MASH. Everything is kind of, you ask yourself, how in the world did we ever win any war? so many things going on there and so mm-hmm. forth. So the other day I uncovered my, I made 16 jumps. And one of the jumps, the next to last jump, all of the, you know, it's like a big football field. There's a drop zone. Mm-hmm. And the next to last drop zone that I dropped on was Los Baños. Mm-hmm. Because that division during World War II had dropped on Los Baños. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't even know what country Los Baños mm-hmm. was in. I was only going to live there 12 or 15 years later, see? But yep. That's the first experience that I had from Los Baños, was in Fort Campbell,
Kentucky. That's incredibly coincidental, yeah.
And I think the zone, I think even today that the drop zones there are still named in that way. Mm-hmm. So there were different places that they had dropped during World War II.
Okay.
And so Los Baños was a prisoner of war camp for Americans, not military, but to captured by the Japanese and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that got me through, you know, at the end of the military, I'm still not clear what I don't want to do. So I decided I'm going to go to grad school. And I chose to go to the Midwest, to Oregon, because I figured, well, or somewhere on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Because I figured, well, the last place you want to be is in the Iowa because it's flat and so forth. So mm-hmm. I go to Oregon, and I do a master's degree there. And then, and that was all decided. Well, they wrote me a nice letter, and I thought Oregon would be an interesting place, and mm-hmm. it was. But then I, professionally, the profession that I was in, like farm management, production economics, the top school was Iowa, mm-hmm. Iowa State.
Sure.
And I had an opportunity to go to Iowa, first to teach farm management semester, then do research. So I ended up going to Ames, Iowa, you know. But I got to like Ames, even though it was mm-hmm. the middle of, you know. And so I, the first thing that happened to me is I would go to the cafeteria, and I'm wearing a necktie. People don't wear neckties in Iowa. And so a guy came running up to me, and he says, oh, he said, we're looking for you. You must be from England. I said, no. I said, I'm from New England. That's good enough. Okay, so I joined, and the group that I was sitting with turned out to be, one of them turned out to be my wife. So that's how I met my wife, in a sort of meeting. These were all Scottish and British, and they were all doing, you know, degrees at Ames.
What was your wife studying?
What?
What was your wife studying?
Well, that's the point. She was studying forestry.
And
the point is, I kept saying to her, how can you study forestry at Iowa? There are no trees. So they said, oh, well, during the, you know, the summer, we would go west. To where there were trees. Mm-hmm. So that was, so forth. So anyway, that took me through grad school, and then I had an opportunity to come back to Cornell and started teaching at Cornell. But then, at that time, Cornell had developed this, well, in fact, earlier, this program with the Philippines, College of Agriculture. So in 1965, I was asked to go to the Philippines on a two-year assignment with my family to exchange professors, what we call them, with the College of Agriculture at Los Baños. So along about the end of my 2 years, the head of the International Rice Research Institute, which was founded only in 1952, they were looking for an economist and asked me if I wanted a job, you know. And you know how it is now, it takes you 6 months and you got to interview and you got to do this.
Yep.
But this guy just came over and said, well, would you like a job? The only thing I said was, well, I'll have to ask my wife. But of course, I didn't ask my wife. Later on, I just said, okay, we'll stay for, instead of staying for 2 years, we'll stay for 12. And so, and so as you notice in that letter that I wrote, that, you know, the family sort of grew up in the Philippines and so forth. So, and that experience was, I mean, this is Southeast Asia, but it's not seep.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so, but the experience was almost unique because mm-hmm. I was the only economist in the International Rice Research Institute, and I had to have coffee with people in other disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me give you an example. You're sitting here in one part of Warren Hall.
Mm-hmm.
This used to be called Ag Economics, but it's now called the Dyson School, mm-hmm. okay? Over there is development sociology.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's just down the hall. We don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We literally do not talk to each other. As if somehow there was no relationship.
Yep.
And what you have in most universities are what we call silos,
mm-hmm.
disciplinary silos.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how you break these silos is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could go in and talk about that, but like
putting
a cafeteria in a library and a few things like that. Yeah. So but anyway,
can I ask you to step back for a second? You mentioned that Cornell already had a program where it was sending professors to the Philippines before you even came. I was wondering, do you know who started that or why they might have?
Yeah. Well, there's a book called the Cornell Los Baños story.
I don't know
if I have that. And it's by Ken Turk.
Okay. I'm sure our library has it.
And it's, I don't know if I even have it handy. Anyway. Well, I know I think I have a copy somewhere, but I don't see it right now.
Okay.
Anyway.
I wrote it down. I can look in the library. I'm sure they have it.
There were two programs. The first started in the 1950s.
Okay.
And was it for undergraduates. It was developing the undergraduate program at the College of Agriculture. And then in the 1960s, when I was there, it was a graduate program.
Okay.
They were strengthening the graduate program. There were probably about 50 professors from Cornell that spent a couple of years in the Philippines. An amazing, amount of effort that was put into that program.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other universities were doing the same similar things, mm-hmm. you know, with contracts.
Yep.
And a lot of this, in our, the first contract was supported by USAID and the second was by the Ford Foundation.
Okay.
And there was a whole era in which not only Southeast Asia, but Asia in general,
mm-hmm.
we meaning the United States, put an enormous amount of money into developing colleges and universities and so forth. Cold War politics.
Mm-hmm.
We were still worried about the possibility that Asia might go communist.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy how we, you know, the American foreign policy is developed by ism.
Mm-hmm.
Communism, terrorism, so forth like mm-hmm. that. So that was the impetus for the whole, effort in mm-hmm. the Philippines,
with
basically the foreign policy. Now, nobody, mm-hmm. including the International Rice Research Institute, which is established in 19... And nobody in the International Rice Research Institute would say, we're here because of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they were.
They were, sure.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so that, and what I think when Bob Chandler retired in 1990, we had a kind of a celebration or seminar in his honor. I said Bob Chandler's legacy was we had a joint venture, Cornell College of Agriculture, Erie,
mm-hmm.
and each benefited from the other, mm-hmm. I mean, and so forth. The other thing that Chandler did is we trained people. And so even today, there's nowhere, I think, where rice is grown in a major way that the people there, some of them have been to Los Baños.
Mm-hmm.
Now you understand, for training of one sort or another. Maybe 3 weeks or 3 months or three years if they're getting a master's or a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But the importance that people don't realize is that not only whether they got good training or bad training, the fact is they were associated with a whole bunch of people with common interests.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back with new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And even now in Burma, we've trained people since 1970s.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, here's this guy that is the director of the Zinla University of Agriculture. He's got his PhD in Los Espanol.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that is an enormously interesting story, and mm-hmm. I think relatively few people understand this whole connection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that takes us sort of up to 78, and that's
mm-hmm.
kind of where SEEP begins to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you understand we're sending grad students, faculty back and forth and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, 10 or 15. None of these people had any connection with SEEP.
Mm, okay.
Because, as, you know, Audu points out, they were basically liberal arts
mm-hmm.
and focusing on issues that there seemed to be no common connection.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the first things when I came back, you know, I think Audu says it well, is that, you know, all of a sudden some of the people in our campus started showing up in SEEP.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And, you know, it was interesting because the liberal arts people, it's not only that they were in liberal arts, but people like Ben Anderson,
mm-hmm.
who was, you know Ben,
mm-hmm.
he's around, he's
sure.
the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Ben Anderson, I mean, man, I tell you, they were not exactly, their attitude about the College of Agriculture, these guys are conservative Republicans, and
mm-hmm.
we're not sure we can have these people in our program,
mm-hmm.
but gradually we convinced them that, well, we weren't too bad, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so that was sort of my entry into SEEP and
mm-hmm.
Milt Barnett and Walt Coward in development sociology were
yep.
also, there were the three of us at that time
mm-hmm.
in SEEP. And so one of my jobs in SEEP was trying to get communication between.
Sure.
Those, and I haven't done it in the last couple of years, but even one of the things that I did was to, the Thursday seminar.
Mm-hmm.
Once a semester, I'd get the Thursday seminar in Mann Library.
Yep. And they still do that. That's carried on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but we haven't done that in a while. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
it's that sort of thing. And it's difficult because not only the coursework, but even the source of funding and so forth is quite different
mm-hmm.
in terms of, down below you had, you know, early days you had Ford, Rockefeller, Lewis Foundation, so forth,
mm-hmm.
built the endowment for the Southeast Asia program.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
sure.
the library was and still is number one, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And that was all done, I think the donors like Ford and Rockefeller Lewis had an amazing vision in terms of seeing that strengthening SEEP. And at the
mm-hmm.
same time, we had Ford money in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
So today's foundations are like Gates are quite different,
mm-hmm.
and,
yep.
and they don't have the knowledge of agriculture or the knowledge of the thing,
mm-hmm.
and so a lot of their money is being wasted.
Mm-hmm.
I think. But anyway, that's later. But
did you have a relationship, or did you know Milton Barnett? Wasn't he up on the Ag Quad as well? And I think he helped sort of bridge the two schools as well, right?
Well,
was he before your time, or was
we were together.
Okay.
And Milton and I, actually, more than that, we taught a course together. We taught
oh, really?
An interdisciplinary okay. course with Gil Levine,
mm-hmm.
I think to some extent Norman Uphoff, myself, mm-hmm. and Milt Barnett. The title of that course was Socio-Technical Aspects of Irrigation.
Mm.
We met once a week for 3 hours in the evening. We had about 30 graduate students. And some of these students were actually doing research on water management overseas or something like that.
Okay.
So we had a, and I'm still working with Gil Levine.
Mm-hmm,
you
sure.
know, I just saw him this morning.
Okay.
On related issues. So we've been working for 50 years.
Okay.
Basically, our concern has been water management, which in the beginning wasn't so important, but now water has become the critical issue in
mm-hmm.
California, in Thailand, in
mm-hmm.
India. We're running out of water.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So when it's become important, we haven't had the training and so forth. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
so yes, we've had Milt Barnett and I were really good friends.
Okay.
And Walt Coward was a third guy. He
mm-hmm.
was also in development sociology.
Okay.
And Gil Levine is an engineer. So we had engineering, rural sociology, economics.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this for 10 years or more, mm-hmm. I don't know. And we used to meet in the Statler and the Rathskeller.
Mm-hmm.
before class to discuss
okay.
what we were going to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And what the students liked about it was the fact that we often argued with each other,
mm-hmm.
you know, in class about
certainly,
that
yeah.
sort of issue. So it was one of my best experiences in teaching
mm-hmm.
and so forth. Yeah.
So was there any focus on Southeast Asia in those classes, or was it more of a global sort of course?
The thing is that we focused to a large extent on Asia.
Okay.
But we didn't distinguish between whether it was South.
Sure.
So I know, and it was a program called IBSRAM, where we had USAID money for, and it was a joint effort with Utah State,
mm-hmm.
Colorado State, and Cornell. It was funded by aid for about at least 5 years or more, and And all of that focus was on Asia in one form or another. I mean, it was different,
mm-hmm.
different and so forth. So we really didn't distinguish
mm-hmm.
The boundary lines. And it's interesting that, you know, it was really the government that decided that we were going to have Southeast Asia
mm-hmm.
some long time ago.
Yeah.
But in some sense, it makes sense. In other sense, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, one of the things that always interests me, and I don't understand this because it's psychological or cultural
mm-hmm.
or something, driving in South Asia is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Driving in Southeast Asia is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that true? Now, China, it must be a nightmare also because they're just getting cars.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a strict line in Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, where I lived for 9 years,
mm-hmm.
And India. I mean, they're driving in Pakistan. Terrible. I mean, it's just road hog and takeover.
Mm-hmm.
and yet, Philippines, and all, it's nowhere near like that. Why
mm-hmm.
is that? I mean, I can't understand why that.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else, not a historian, but somebody else
yeah.
needs to explain culturally
mm-hmm.
why is that different. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
so you left me with Milt Barnett and so forth, and we
mm-hmm.
had the interdisciplinary course. Now where are we?
Well, we were discussing you before that. You were discussing your sort of move to SEEP in 1978, and right when you took over the directorship. And
yeah.
The bridging of North
yeah.
Campus and
well, mm-hmm. and I mentioned a couple of things in that going then into the 80s, one of the first things in the 80s was the incident which I told you about bringing Ninoy Aquino to the campus. And it was kind of, the interesting thing is that Ninoy Aquino comes from Tarlac, which is a province in the Philippines. And it so happened that the first time I actually met him, USAID had a project, I forget what it was called, to give support to two provinces, Laguna and Tarlac, for increasing rice production. So the Aquino family had a sugar central in operation called Luisita. And so I went up there and early on with some, in fact, the Luisita plane came down to near Los Banos, and we flew up in the Luisita plane to Tarlac. Well, the after the conflict with Marcos, between the Marcos and Aquino, Marcos basically jailed Aquino, I mean house arrest or something, for about 7 or 8 years. And then he was allowed to go to Texas for a heart surgery. And then for some, I guess for some reason, he was allowed then to go to Harvard. So I was over doing something else at the Kennedy School, and I discovered he's in the same building. So I went up and talked to him and said, look, why don't you come to Cornell? And so he said, fine. And so he, as I mentioned to you, that he came and gave a seminar. And it was a time when the campus was sort of split over the undergraduate liberal arts was more Marcos people, and these young people up here were Aquino people, so there was a lot of little friction between the two. And it's interesting because Cornell brings together odd sorts of people that around the world that are normally arguing each other. In Taiwan, they we had students here from that were native Taiwanese with people from the mainland, and they were at war with each other, and so forth like that. But at Cornell, they were they got to know each other. And you see, later on, when I taught the course in Vietnam, and the North and South Vietnamese, they discovered they liked each other. Anyway, like that. So Aquino came, and that, I think I'm trying to think of anything major. I think the key thing to see is that, as Audrey brings out quite well in her manuscript, is the kind of ebbing and flowing of support from the government, and very much related to American foreign policy. And so we entered an area where post-Vietnam, and the support for all kinds of stuff, Asian, dropped. And it really dropped even further after the Cold War. Everybody figured, well, Asia can take care of itself, and we don't have any problem down there. So, and we simply neglected Asia. And really for a generation. And I became director of the program in, I guess I'm trying to think, 89 or something like that. And then at that time, one of the things that I was trying to do was kind of build up a little bit of interaction with former former students,
mm-hmm.
or that were now faculty somewhere. So we developed a kind of a council,
mm-hmm.
and in that council was the important guy was a fellow called Uehara,
okay.
who was with a long-term credit bank, and the connection there was actually Ben Anderson and a guy called Takashi Shiraishi,
mm-hmm. sure.
Were in the Southeast Asia program, and they...
He was a historian, right? I believe, Takashi?
Takashi,
yeah.
I think so, and mm-hmm. but they were very much interested in Indonesia mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and so Takashi had the link and the friend in this Uehara,
mm-hmm.
and so we had even a I can remember one time that we had a conference. Well, we had a conference in Indonesia on the role of the Chinese in Indonesian mm-hmm. development, and it was interesting because people this was in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and because people came from Indonesia
mm-hmm.
to say what they couldn't say at home.
Ah, sure. Yes, this is still under Suharto. And
Audrey mentions the conference, but she doesn't really pay enough attention to the actual what happened at that conference because, as I say, the attendance, we thought we might get 30 people, and we got about 100 people.
Oh, really?
That came to that. I mean, the attendance was much larger than we anticipated, but along with this, it was sponsorship in some ways from the Japanese.
Okay.
And I can remember that we rented what you know they had this boat
mm-hmm.
Restaurant boat
okay.
down at the harbor
mm-hmm.
and we took the boat out with a whole bunch of us
mm-hmm.
on that. Conference, and I don't know. It was really a successful conference.
Mm-hmm.
And following that, I think came the problem that the building in West Avenue had been condemned, mm-hmm. the Southeast Asia building. And so the problem was to find a new building, and you know to move the. Well, it took. Over a year from the time that they were condemned, they were for 1 year the Southeast Asia program operated in Rice Hall.
Oh, really? Okay. And, right here on Tower Road, just up. Okay.
Because that was an empty. For some reason, they had just done away with the poultry department. And they thought the Southeast Asia program would be okay.
It's kind of fitting, you know.
Instead of the poultry. So they put, you know, they put us there for a year. And during that time, we talked with Uehara, who was a really nice guy, about getting money from the long-term credit bank in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to New York to see him, and I had Uehara was the American representative of the long-term credit bank, and he had an office on Wall Street. His office was like something out of Hollywood. It was huge glass. Looked right over the Statue of Liberty, like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my son was also working on Wall Street, and so I said, why don't we arrange to have lunch, and could you arrange for the restaurant, you know? So I knew I was coming from somewhere else, and I got to a place called Church Street,
mm-hmm.
where the restaurant was supposed to be. And I thought to myself, gosh, this is a pretty shabby neighborhood. But maybe it'll be better as I walk along. Well, it got worse.
Mm-hmm.
And here's this restaurant. You'd have to imagine a New Yorker cartoon that there's a strip bar here and a burlesque theater there and this restaurant here with all these people in fancy clothes and dress and so forth on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon Uehara arrives in his car, you know, so forth. So that
they must have had a good chef then if they're bringing folks in ties to that neighborhood,
So gosh, you know, it was it only could happen in New York. Anyway, so Uehara provided us with $500,000 for remodeling the Cannon Building.
Okay.
Which originally cost the university about $25,000, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. And what was his connection to it? Why would he give that much money? Did he have a connection to Cornell or to the program?
Well, he had this connection partly through Takashi.
Okay.
Shiraishi.
Mm-hmm.
And because, and actually he did not have his, I think he had a son in Columbia, but I'm not sure exactly, but it was all, Ben Anderson would know better than I about how, you know, why he decided to, you know, give money to Cornell.
Sure.
And Audrey would probably know also. But in any event, that wasn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next thing we had to do was raise another $500,000. Well, we had to convince the university to put in money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it just so happened that the two people that were important in the university, the provost, is Mel Nesheim, and the acting head of the Ionity Center, Gil Levine, were friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fortunate because the guy that was normally the director of the center had gone on a sabbatical leave, but he would have probably wondered why we were giving him money to the Southeast Asia program and not to, you know, we were fortunate to have him out of town. and so once you, and the thing is, once the university commits to taking the long-term credit bank money, you've got them over the barrel.
Okay.
Because, you know, they can say to you, well, help us raise the rest, but we're no good at raising money. So so they end up having to, and it turned out to be about $1.2 million. Mm. And in those days, we had to do a lot of things. You know, for example, we had to meet the regulations of, the state regulations on access to, you know, handicaps and stuff like that.
Sure.
I had to go to Syracuse to talk to the people about the building and the handicaps and this and that.
Yeah, the elevator,
and
I'm sure.
And having an elevator and having access. That elevator, we didn't need the elevator, but we had the elevator. And, and the elevator, you know, if you look, the infrastructure, the top of the elevator, stuck out over the in the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
So the architects built a false chimney, so you don't know.
Oh, really? Okay.
Like that. So, interesting.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that was sort of my main contribution in that time to the Southeast Asia program. And then right after that, I went to Sri Lanka for quite a period. And again, this is water management. I didn't have much contact with the program until, well, I was in Sri Lanka, and then I was a year in the Philippines, acting head of the social sciences. And these were both acting head and so like that.
Sure.
So, and I think that Then I come back recently to, when I moved back to Cornell, then I'm again associated with Southeast Asia mm-hmm. program. As I mentioned, I'm sort of in the East Asia. And, mm-hmm. And the thing I wanted to show you, you see, I think this is important even for historians.
Okay.
And that is that, you know, this whole question of how the program develops, country focus, regional focus, so forth,
mm-hmm.
and it goes back to this question of India, East, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia. Okay, now, the current issue in Asia today, you know, we repositioned our thinking that maybe Asia is important because mm-hmm. of China, right?
Yep, definitely.
Well, it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Vietnamese, one of the reasons the Vietnamese like us is because we dislike the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we're afraid of it, and they're worried about the Chinese.
Yep, and have been for thousands of years, huh?
And so... And so we're monkeying around in the Middle East and both Taiwan and Vietnam are nervous
mm-hmm.
because we don't seem to be paying attention.
Yep.
And so now we come back, and the point is that when you start looking at what I think people should be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
It's the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I mean, this is a map of, mm-hmm. you know, the South China Sea and, mm-hmm. and who claims what.
Oh, okay.
And Vietnam,
it's a nice map.
And this book actually has a chapter country by country.
Mm.
So you understand, for example, in Vietnam, Vietnam has something called the, it's not the Spratlys, the Spratlys, these mm-hmm. are the Paracel Islands.
Okay,
now the Paracel Islands are claimed by both Vietnam and China.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was a conference held here in, well, I can tell you when the conference was held.
And that book is Asia's Cauldron by Robert Kaplan.
It was a conference of people who had been running Vietnam before the collapse in 75. Voices from the Past is what it's called.
Okay.
As soon as I find this,
mm-hmm.
but I'll give you the date. Okay, this is the conference here, and it's in...
Symposium brings scholars together.
Okay, now...
Oh, John Fenn, yeah, I know John.
Yeah, he's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Is he still here?
No, he graduated. I think he's teaching somewhere now. I think he finished his PhD.
Yeah.
So he's teaching somewhere. I'm not sure if he's in Singapore or if he's in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, one of these people
mm-hmm.
is an admiral. And in fact, I have somewhere his email, but this admiral...
President to you, Minister of Mass Mobilization, Open Arms, to the former Rear Admiral of the South Vietnamese Navy,
yeah.
Former
okay,
Minister of Trade
guy.
And Industry. Yep.
Well, the Rear Admiral is sent to the Paracels because the Chinese are coming, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, he's not sure what he's supposed to do. Is he supposed to shoot or not shoot or so mm-hmm. forth? So he calls up the 7th Fleet, and the 7th Fleet doesn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then he calls Saigon, and Saigon doesn't answer. So he's there alone. Mm-hmm. And he ends up shooting, and there's a little bit of a conflict, which eventually dissipates. But anyway, and so it's just a sort of, you do this, and then you back off. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they did back off anyway. But this is 1974. Mm-hmm. 1976, I'm in the southern part of China, mm-hmm. and this is 76, just after Mao died. I was with an Erie team, and we spent 3 weeks in China, and almost the last day we're there, they take us to a movie. Mm-hmm. The movie is about the Spratling, the same event. Mm-hmm. From the Chinese point of view. Okay, mm-hmm. So the movie, the Chinese boat, the captain is a peasant, mm-hmm. and next to the captain is the party secretary, okay? And they're going like this. And then the Vietnamese boat is coming this way. Now, you can tell by the way the Vietnamese look that these guys are evil, mm-hmm. okay?
Yep.
It's like an American melodrama, see? Mm-hmm. And so, then the Chinese captain gets ready to shoot, and the party secretary puts his hand on the Chinese captain. He says, "We don't shoot till they shoot first." Straight out of John Wayne.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
right?
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, you see, mm-hmm. now, do you know Twee?
Mm-hmm,
well,
sure.
Anyway, Twee's out in vacation, actually, and so, but Twee has the email of this admiral.
Oh, okay.
So I was been thinking I should tell him about the more recent event. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the same thing. About a year or two ago, they brought this oil rig down, mm-hmm. and they had another kind of a spat, mm-hmm. and another uprising. So I think this in part explains to me why Vietnam is probably the safest place for an American to be,
mm-hmm.
Even safer maybe than the U.S., I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. But because in my entire contact with Vietnam, which started in 1990, in the north, we had an FAO project with the State Planning Committee. I never had nobody ever said, "Oh, you American, you've bombed the hell out of us."
Mm-hmm.
It was quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. When I stayed at this old French hotel, which is now called the Metropole, but for $200 a night, you could stay there an hour or 300. But in those days, it was $35 a mm-hmm. night because you had rats running around the room. But anyway, so I'm staying at this hotel, and the first thing they want to know is, am I Russian or am I American?
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that if I'm American, I'm in better shape
yeah.
than if I'm Russian.
Sure.
Okay, from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I go outside, and there's a lady standing there selling maps,
mm-hmm.
and for a dollar. And it's exactly what I need. I buy a map for a dollar. And then she says, "Why don't you come and look at my book stall?"
Mm-hmm.
Well, she had a book stall in Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
that had all the important publications. I mean, it was a stall.
Mm.
But she, you tell her what you wanted, and she you couldn't get this stuff in Saigon.
Huh.
They'd pull out the stuff,
mm-hmm.
and all the data and the reports and stuff, mm-hmm. like that. So for years, every time I go to Hanoi, I go back and look at, mm-hmm. this lady's stall, and so forth. And
mm-hmm.
so, and as I say, okay, so then I go back and I say to this lady, I say, "Oh, I need some twine to wrap some stuff up." She says, "Oh, that's my brother or somebody. Get on the back of that motorcycle." So we go right through Hanoi, and we come to a rope shop. They got big rope. They got little rope. All I wanted was a ball of twine. So for 50 cents, I buy the ball of twine, see? And then I go back through on the back of the, you know they call it, in Vietnam, they call it Seom. You hang on.
Okay.
It's like a taxi, see?
Sure.
You never do that in the U.S., right?
No, definitely not.
So anyway, I think the key point, what I make here, what I'm trying to make with you in this story is that the South China Sea, looking at Southeast Asia as a front of the South China Sea, is useful because it brings out the variability in the different countries in terms of their situation relative to U.S. foreign policy.
Sure.
Now, Vietnam is one case, but the Philippines is another.
Mm-hmm.
And the Philippines claims the Spratly Islands, or some of the Spratly Islands. And so the Philippines is sending out its flagship fleet to the Spratly Islands. The flagship fleet is a World War II destroyer. And the Chinese are coming with an aircraft carrier. See?
Yep.
And so, aren't you worried? You guys are going to get hurt. Oh, no, we'll call the 7th Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the Philippines is totally dependent upon American cover for any of these incidents. And you see, what's happened is they put all of their money into the Army and not the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
So they really don't have a Navy of any sort. But each country, I like that book because each country, there's a chapter that, some of the chapters are better than others, but it tells you the situation of that country relative to the South China Sea.
Because I think they all claim so many islands that are the same, right? I mean, the Spratlys, I think Indonesia claims a few of them, Malaysia, and they're all involved in this conflict.
And Taiwan also claims some of those islands, and so...
Yep.
And the Chinese, every now and then somebody's trying to establish a claim by putting somebody out there.
Yep. China's even been developing a few of the islands recently, putting developments there, trying to claim them through development architecture, these sort of things.
So it's to me, it's the key issue that the country faced. Now, I may be wrong, but my impression in the Southeast Asia program is that nobody's really focused on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they have other issues, but there isn't anybody you could say that really is looking at that. I may be wrong. There may be somebody that I don't, possibly, what's his name? Who's the guy that...
In which department?
Yeah.
In government or in...
Well, you know...
I think there's people who are...
He's been on leave in China.
Oh, Magnus Fiskesio.
Magnus.
Yeah, in anthropology. I think he works mostly in the mountains. I was going to say, I think maybe Tom Papinski has interest in ASEAN and what they do with regards to sort of connections across the South China Sea, things like that. But I don't think there's anybody that I'm aware of that's specifically working on that issue. Andrew Murtha works on China-Cambodia relations, but it's not related to the South China Sea.
Yeah.
It's related to development in Cambodia.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think there is, but when we have conferences, or we bring in speakers, there's a lot of people working on that issue right now at other institutions. It's a hot topic, especially ASEAN and their concerns with the South China Sea.
Well, the final thing I wanted to mention to you is that while I was in Sri Lanka for 5 years, I taught a course in Vietnam at the Harvard Fulbright program on rural development in Vietnam, And it was sort of, I had a co-teacher, and of course I had to have an interpreter and a whole bunch of sure. other things. I finally got to the point that I said the interpreter may be doing a better job than me. But anyway, I taught that for 5 years. It was one of the best courses because, you see, one of the big advantages was that I could set the exam, but I didn't have to grade it.
Oh, nice, yes.
You know, so anyway, I'm now trying to develop a similar course in Yezin in Burma.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working, this is actually, Tamora official and mm-hmm. knows what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Cornell is trying to develop a sort of, a platform
mm-hmm.
in which to operate. And Ronnie Kaufman has a person, Kim Marcho, who's oddly enough used to be at the Extension Program in New York City, but she's working now with Ronnie, and she's stationed in Yangon. And what I'm hoping to do this fall, I'm going to be gone August, September, is take a week and go and work with a couple of people to develop a syllabus for mm-hmm. a course as a starting point to begin to develop more collaboration like we used to have in the Philippines with Myanmar and with mm-hmm. with Yezin. So that's kind of where I am now
okay.
in terms of Southeast Asia programming. Mm-hmm. So
not this fall you're traveling to Burma or to Myanmar and to China.
I should if all goes well. I mean, I'll spend a week
okay.
in the fall in Myanmar
mm-hmm.
in September. And then there's a conference back here in October
mm-hmm.
on Myanmar
mm-hmm.
that the grad students are running.
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I saw it advertised in the email a few weeks ago that got sent out.
Yeah, they were asking for...
Call for papers.
Yeah, I don't know, mm-hmm. I don't know who they're going to invite
mm-hmm.
or whatnot, but yeah, that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a growing interest, and mm-hmm. you know, again, Steve always has to worry about, well, is the Department of Education going to fund us next year?
Mm-hmm. Or, sure.
You know, and language in particular,
mm-hmm.
you see, because the provost has been providing some of the support for language
mm-hmm.
for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So you always worry about language library, you know, keeping money for those
mm-hmm.
those things.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
That was really helpful.
Now I can send you the Taiwan thing.
Okay, sure. That would be great. I really enjoyed reading your letters from Los Baños. That painted a really interesting picture of what went on in the Philippines during that period and connections to Cornell.
Yeah.
It was fun reading.
Yeah. Well, the one that you see, the thing on Taiwan is this. 1963, the first time I went overseas, I went to Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only time I was actually on a government contract.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was paid by whether USAID or somebody, I don't know. So it's the first time I'd ever been out of the U.S., you know. And there was something called the Chinese American Joint Commission on Rural Reconstruction, which was based on actually before World War II in the 30s, Cornell had a project
mm-hmm.
with Nanjing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most interesting projects because two people were involved in that. And one was in this department, John Losing Buck,
mm-hmm.
whose wife was Pearl Buck. Mm. Everybody knows about Pearl Buck, but nobody knows about John Losing Buck. But he's done the most remarkable survey of, he surveyed 13,000 farmers. And some of the people in this department were over. And you know, his computer was a room full of ladies with abacus, you know. And so there's a study going on here in the department to follow up on what happened then.
Oh, okay.
And so forth. But there was also a guy called H.H. Love. And one of the problems is I'm disorganized. Anyway, I'm looking for something called the Cornell Nanjing story.
Okay.
There's a Cornell Los Banos story that mm-hmm. is Ken Turk, and there's a Cornell Nanjing story that goes back to before World War II. But the point is that the people, many of the people that were in Nanjing, went to Taiwan,
mm-hmm.
and they set up a program in Taiwan, the Joint Commission on it. And it was funded mainly by USAID. But there were three commissioners, and two were Chinese and one was American. And they, it was extremely successful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I first went over in the 60s, Taiwan was looked at as a model for agricultural development.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thought the Philippines might do something, but the Philippines never did.
Mm-hmm. See.
But Taiwan, agriculture really took off.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the people that I shared an office with in this joint commission in 63 was mm-hmm. a guy called Lee Tung Hui. And Lee Tung Hui, in 60, he came... In 65, when I was leaving to go to the Philippines, Lee Tung Hui came here to do his PhD. And he got a PhD in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Tung Hui was a native Taiwanese. And after he's got his PhD, he's still a second-class citizen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Chen Qingkuo decides that in order to do away with this conflict between the mainlanders and the native Taiwanese, you needed to have at least somebody representing the Taiwanese in the government.
Mm-hmm.
So Lee Tung Hui had just published his book on his thesis, which won an award. And so... he was appointed minister without portfolio
mm-hmm.
around 1969, although agriculture was his main focus. Well, he went from, you have to imagine this guy was a serious academic guy in 63 and 68. Mm-hmm. Then I didn't see him until he was mayor of Taipei. And all of a sudden, he's a politician, smiling. Mm-hmm. And, somebody must have trained him. You know, I mean, literally, as to how to be a politician. So he moved up the ladder, and I couldn't believe that he would go all the way up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
But when Chiang Kai-shek died, he became president of Taiwan. And so in August, when I go out to the Philippines, I'm going to take a few days and go over and see him. He's 94.
Oh, wow.
And he's, I've been in touch with him because he's in good health. But then next fall, I agreed with the East Asia program that I would give a seminar on Li Tongwei, Taiwan, and China living through something times. Mm-hmm. Dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So in October or November, I just talked with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so that, mm-hmm. So Taiwan has always been interesting, but you know, it mm-hmm. does, there's another thing you need to think about as a historian, mm-hmm. and that is, there's a kind of a routine, and I'm not even sure that we don't operate with the same thing. The first, step one is, and I remember Lee telling me very directly at one time when I was at his house, the first step is to survive. And the next step is politically, you have to appeal to everybody to get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you're elected, you may do what you want, but one of the first things that happens in Asia anyway and some, is you organize a campaign against corruption to get rid of your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon you're corrupt yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, Lee follows that pattern, but this guy Z, who's now the He's the same sort of guy. Mm-hmm. See, he gets this, goes around and campaigns and gets himself elected. Mm-hmm. And the first thing he's doing now is he's running this campaign against corruption,
yep,
and something like that. And that's, you may know better than I, but mm-hmm. historians must understand there's a pattern in the way. I mean, even in our government to some mm-hmm. extent. Is that, you know, you get to a certain point, and the only as I say, the only difference between corruption in the Philippines and corruption in the U.S. is that our corruption is legal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big mm-hmm. banks, they don't.
Sure.
Nobody goes to jail.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, definitely.
Now, what's the title of your thesis?
Right now it is Producing a Global Rainforest, Colonialism, Conservation, and the Opening of Sumatra's Highlands.
Yeah.
Looking from 1900 when the Dutch first arrived in North Sumatra.
What's the geographic focus?
South Aceh and North Sumatra area. There's a national park there, Gunung Lusur National Park.
Yeah.
It's one of the largest in Indonesia, and so I'm focusing on the history of that national park region. Yeah. Before it was a national park up until just after independence.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had a student from Aceh, and I don't know anything about it except that people that come, as I understand this, people that come from Aceh are quite direct and outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, you know, professors, you're usually pretty polite and mm-hmm. things like that. So this guy once, He told me, he said, you know, he said, he passed the exam, he was very mm-hmm. smart, but he said, well, I never understood your lectures. And I've had people tell me that before, because I sort of soft-spoken, and sometimes mm-hmm. people don't get it. One time I was in the Philippines, there was a secretary. No, in Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
and I'm in touch with her even now, and so she was. We had a conference, and actually, one of Gil Levine's students was the head of the International Water Management Institute at that time, Tom Wickham, and this lady was assigned to take notes at a seminar, and then I don't know. She told me at some point later on. She said I went up, and it said to Dr. Wickham, I have a problem. He said, what's your problem? He said, I couldn't understand a word that Dr. Barker said. So, yeah, I have to, you see, my problem is I don't hear too well, but the worst part is people don't hear me.
Yeah, so. And that's nothing new. You've been doing that for a while, huh? Speaking, your voice has been low for...
Well, what time is it?
It is 4:15. That was great. Well, thank you so much. Here's your magazine back. But let me make sure this all...